It's not the easiest drug to prescribe. It can cause GI problems, sexual dysfunction, weight gain, and rare but dangerous reactions like cardiac arrhythmias that are made even riskier by common drug interactions. But the medication we just described is citalopram, Celexa. And yes, we could say similar things about noradrenaline, but today we're going to ask you to drop any preconceived notions you have about new versus old antidepressants, because there are times when you need to use this tricyclic, and it's a lot better tolerated than commonly thought. Welcome to the Carlyle Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlyle Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. Electroconvulsive therapy, ECT, is one of the most effective treatments for depression we have. But it's not very good at keeping patients well. 80% of patients will go right back into the depression within 6 months of stopping it. We can improve on those disappointing odds with treatment, but which treatment does the best job of preventing depression after ECT? Michael Posternak tackles that question in this month's Carlyle Report, and he distills the literature down to three treatments that can keep your patient well after a successful course of ECT. One of those is the combination of lithium and an antidepressant, particularly noradrenaline.
It's arguable that any antidepressant might do the job there, and that lithium is the med that's making the difference at keeping people well. But the specific recommendation of noradrenaline is based on a trial by Harold Sackheim and colleagues from 2001. The study randomized patients to three treatments after successful course of ECT: noradrenaline, noradrenaline plus lithium, or placebo. 6 months later, here's how things looked. For those on placebo, 84% had relapsed back into depression. We do a little better with noradrenaline, 60% relapsed on that, but the winner was noradrenaline-lithium combination with only a 39% relapse rate. We know noradrenaline is not at the top of everyone's prescription pad these days, so in this podcast, we're going to teach you how to use this tricyclic antidepressant. But first, a little more about lithium. Something in Dr. Sackheim's study stood out to me. Nearly all of the relapses on the lithium noradrenaline group occurred in the first 5 weeks after stopping ECT. All but one of those relapses, in fact. And that wasn't the case for the other treatments, where the relapses were more evenly spread out throughout the 6 month study.
What do you make of that, Dr. Aiken?
Well, I think it tells us a lot about lithium. There are two camps on lithium. Some think it's a powerful treatment for depression, and others see it as a fairly weak and best reserved for bipolar disorder. And depending on which studies you look at, you could reasonably come out on either of those sides. In the short-term studies, lithium augmentation comes up average or below average for its antidepressant effects. And that might explain why Dr. Sackheim's study had the highest relapse in the short term in those first 5 weeks on lithium. But it's in the long-term studies that lithium really shines, so lithium may be much better at preventing depression than treating it acutely. Lithium is not a fast-acting medication, but its long-term effects are pretty robust. So in Sackheim's study, if your patient made it past the first 5 weeks after ECT without getting depressed on lithium and noradrenaline, they had a 95% chance of staying well throughout the study. In long-term studies, lithium also lowers the risk of suicide and even prevents rehospitalization after unipolar depression.
Here are some shocking results from a 2017 Finnish study that illustrates that point. They looked at 120,000 patients who had been hospitalized for depression to see which medications helped them stay out of the hospital. This study was long-term, with an average follow-up of 9 years. And the medication that helped them stay out of the hospital the most was lithium. Patients on lithium were twice as likely to stay out of the hospital. The antidepressants and antipsychotics, however, offered no protection. And that is a surprise, because these were unipolar depressed patients, not bipolar.
So if lithium can keep severely depressed patients out of the hospital, it makes sense that it could also help people who recently recovered with ECT from relapsing. Dr. Sackheim's study is not the only one that shows protective effects with lithium after ECT. This year, a meta-analysis looked at 14 studies that followed some 10,000 patients after ECT and concluded that lithium was effective at preventing post-ECT relapse. The target serum level for lithium in depression is 0.6 to 0.8, which is generally the range used in those studies. Most of them paired lithium with an antidepressant, and it wasn't always a tricyclic. One successful study paired lithium with venlafaxine, Effexor, after ECT. But the gold standard is nortriptyline, as that is the antidepressant with the best evidence for this lithium combo after ECT. So let's look more at how to use nortriptyline in depression.
First, you need to adjust your attitude. If you don't use tricyclics very much, you may be thinking these are heavy-duty meds that are difficult to tolerate. But in reality, they are a lot better tolerated than medications we prescribe routinely nowadays, like aripiprazole, Abilify.
In the 1960s and 70s, many psychiatrists had a negative attitude toward medication in general, not just because of side effects, but because medications were seen as a crutch, a way of avoiding and covering up the real problems that should be worked through in psychotherapy. Alan Schatzberg recalls that time and draws from it some advice that can help us today. Kelly, can you read from his Manual of Clinical Psychopharmacology?
One very important issue is attitude. Early on, some psychiatrists commonly had rather negative views about medication, which were communicated indirectly or overtly to the patient, particularly if the impetus to try medications had arisen from the patient and not the physician. In our experience, such attitudes can be troubling to the patient, who must rely on the physician's belief in the importance of medication trials and in being able to deal with the side effects. So let's take a look at those side effects. To make them easier to remember, we'll divide them into three categories: anticholinergic, cardiovascular, and the usual. Nortriptyline has the usual side effects that bother patients on most medications. I call them the big three: sedation, weight gain, and sexual dysfunction. Nortriptyline is a little more favorable than most tricyclics in those areas, but if sedation is an issue, the least sedating tricyclic is disipramine. There's actually a fourth one on the big three list: cognitive problems, but nortriptyline is pretty favorable there. In fact, like a lot of noradrenergic medications, it treats ADHD. Rarely, though, people can get delirium and mental status changes on nortriptyline and other tricyclics due to their anticholinergic properties. And you may see this in the elderly or medically ill. Fortunately, nortriptyline is low on anticholinergic burden. That infamy goes to amitriptyline, the tricyclic with the most potent anticholinergic properties.
And that's unfortunate, because amitriptyline has the most side effects overall of any tricyclic, and it's also the one that you're most commonly going to see prescribed to patients for things like migraines, pain, and insomnia, which can bias how you view these meds. Now, here's a pearl about amitriptyline. If you've ever prescribed amitriptyline, you've also prescribed nortriptyline, because amitriptyline breaks down into nortriptyline, which is its main metabolite.
Back to side effects. We have the usual big three, and the second category is anticholinergic, the ones that dry you up and prevent you from getting rid of urine and stool. So we're talking about constipation, dry mouth, and urinary retention. These are all more likely in the elderly, and they can all have serious consequences. Dry mouth puts people at risk for dental problems, gum inflammation, and tooth decay. Constipation can cause bowel obstruction with potentially fatal paralytic ileus and sepsis, and urinary retention can lead to urinary tract infections and renal or bladder damage. Another anticholinergic effect is blurry vision and difficulty accommodating or reading at close range. Finally, we get to the cardiac side effects, and there are two big ones to know: orthostasis and arrhythmias. Nortriptyline is actually the least likely of the tricyclics to cause orthostasis and falls, which is why it's often preferred in the elderly. Cardiac arrhythmias, like conduction delays, where the heart slows to a dead stop, are what make tricyclics lethal. A week's supply of the medication is often enough to create a fatal dose. To recap, here are nortriptyline side effects. The usual big three: sexual, weight gain, and sedation. Anticholinergic: constipation, urine retention, dry mouth, blurry vision. And cardiac: orthostatic falls and arrhythmias.
Now for how to dose nortriptyline. There is no secret formula other than start low and raise slowly, like every 4 to 7 days. The PDR doesn't even have a titration schedule for this medication. How slow and how low you go will depend on the patient. Go easier on the elderly, the medically ill, and the anxious and somatic sensitive. However you raise it, the target dose for nortriptyline is 50 to 150 milligrams a day. And here we have some sample schedules to get you there.
For the average patient, Dr. Aiken starts at 25 milligrams and raises by 25 milligrams a week until he gets to 75 milligrams, and then reassesses and personalizes from there. He gives it all at night, which the PDR says is okay to do, unless the patient is at risk for orthostasis, then he gives some in the morning. For more sensitive patients, he'll start with a 10 milligram dose to test things out, and then raise it a little faster if possible. Dr. Alan Schatzberg starts higher at 50 milligrams a day for 1 week, and then 100 milligrams a day. But in the elderly, he recommends starting at 25 milligrams a day and increasing after 3 to 4 days to 50 milligrams per day. Dr. David also raises it a little faster. He recommends to start nortriptyline at 10 or 25 milligrams at night, increase by 10 to 25 every 2 days, until 50 to 150 per day in divided doses, and then check the level.
And here's a tip. You often see that recommendation to titrate a drug every 3 to 4 days. Why do they do that? I think the reason has to do with half-lives. Remember that serum levels are going to rise a little higher each day as you approach steady state, which is 5 half-lives. Nortriptyline's half-life is 24 hours, so that means 5 days. What this means in practice is that if a patient tolerates 25 milligrams on day 1, it doesn't mean they will tolerate that dose on day 2, because the serum level is going to be higher on day 2, and higher still on day 3, until it reaches steady state on day 5. A lot of experts wait 5 half-lives to raise the medication further, because that gives them more assurance that the patient is really tolerating that dose as the level builds up. So why do I do it every 7 days? That's just easier for patients to remember, and it gives them a little buffer for a few days for them to get used to the higher, steady-state level of each dose before raising it further. If you raise a medication too quickly, the patient may call complaining of side effects on the 50 milligram dose, when it's really the buildup towards steady state on the 25 milligram dose that they are complaining about.
We've covered side effects, dosing, and now for the fun part, serum levels. Nortriptyline is one of tricyclics with a clearly defined therapeutic serum level. The others are imipramine and possibly disipramine. Now, if you really delve into the literature, you'll find that clearly defined is not as clear as we'd like to think. There were some flaws in the studies that established these serum levels. So follow your patient's response and don't be too rigid about the serum level.
And nortriptyline's serum level is unique among the tricyclics because it forms a U-shaped curve, meaning it has cutoffs on both the high and low side. Imipramine and disipramine have only a lower threshold that you need to pass, a one-sided curve. But nortriptyline has a sweet spot, and that sweet spot is between 50 and 150 nanograms per milliliter.
And that's easy to remember because the therapeutic dose is 50 to 150 and the therapeutic level is 50 to 150. Just the units are different.
And both of those cutoffs matter, the 50 and the 150 level, because depression tends to get worse when you go below 50 nanograms per milliliter or when the serum level rises above the 150 mark.
The blood level should be checked 8 to 12 hours after the last dose. And as with all psych meds, wait at least 5 half-lives, which is 5 days for nortriptyline before checking the level.
You know, it's interesting that serum levels matter for tricyclics, but we almost never check them with other antidepressants. And while it might be that tricyclics have very specific effects on the brain that need a more precise level to enact, there's another explanation that has a clinical pearl buried within it. Tricyclics are rather sensitive to drug interactions and genetic differences in the CYP metabolic enzymes, particularly the 2D6 enzyme. So even when you dose a tricyclic by weight, giving the same milligrams per kilogram dose, the blood levels in different patients can vary by up to 30-fold. In today's world, patients are asking us to check their pharmacogenetic panels, but for 50 years, psychiatrists have been essentially doing just that, only in a more direct way, by checking the blood levels of tricyclics, because those CYP enzymes are the most important part of the pharmacogenetic panel, like 2D6. Bottom line, while it might be that the brain needs precise levels of tricyclics, it's also true that those levels are going to vary a lot in different patients based on drug interactions and different genetics, so they are definitely worth checking.
And with tricyclics, it's not just efficacy we worry about, but safety, because high levels can cause cardiac arrhythmias. And that brings us to the fourth and final step in our how-to guide, drug interactions. We'll keep that simple. Check them when your patient is taking a tricyclic. Each one is a little different, but nortriptyline is relatively simple. It exits the body through one primary route, CYP2D6. Anything that slows this enzyme down is going to raise the tricyclic levels, and that includes bupropion, Wellbutrin, duloxetine, Cymbalta, and most SSRIs except citalopram and escitalopram. So start the tricyclic 50% lower and aim for 50% lower when one of these 2D6 inhibitors is on board. And you don't have to worry about drug interactions between lithium and nortriptyline. And we hope you'll consider that combination when your patient returns after a successful course of ECT.
Many psychiatrists prefer nortriptyline as their go-to tricyclic for severe depression, even when ECT is not part of the picture, although disipramine is probably tied for popularity. The reason is that both of these are relatively well-tolerated for their class, and both have well-described blood levels that can guide their prescribing. We'll close now with a case that drives this all home. The patient arrived for her first visit profoundly depressed, not eating, barely moving, and almost mute because her thinking was so slow. But 6 months earlier, she was doing great. She had recovered fully on ECT. After recovery, she was treated with nortriptyline, lithium, and an antipsychotic. So what went wrong? Well, she developed a pretty bad tremor, so the psychiatrist stopped the lithium. That's when she arrived at my office, free of tremor, but fully depressed. The changes were slow and subtle, so no one thought that coming off lithium had anything to do with her current depression. But based on this research, I thought it was. I restarted the lithium, and she recovered 100%.
What about the tremor?
Well, remember, she was on nortriptyline, lithium, and an antipsychotic. And there's a drug interaction that you'll often see reported for lithium with antipsychotics, neurotoxicity. That sounds like some kind of brain damage, but really, neurotoxicity just means that both these drugs can make people very tremulous, stiff, and possibly confused. In fact, most evidence actually suggests that these are just additive effects of lithium and antipsychotics rather than a real drug interaction. But there it stands in the PDR, causing unnecessary alarm for many patients and pharmacists. So if lithium and antipsychotics both raise the risk of tremor, and lithium is the only one of those two meds that's really likely to keep someone well after ECT, it makes more sense to come off the antipsychotic, particularly in this patient who didn't have psychotic features. So that's what we did after restarting the lithium. We slowly took the antipsychotic off. With those changes, she tolerated nortriptyline and lithium quite well after we got rid of the antipsychotic.
That was an elderly patient, and we shouldn't shy away from lithium and nortriptyline in the elderly after ECT, even though they are more vulnerable to side effects. In a recent meta-analysis, lithium's post-ECT protective effects were even stronger in the elderly. But lithium is not the only way to keep people well after ECT. Check out Dr. Posternak's review online for a full review of the options. I think at least one of them will surprise you.
And now for the word of the day, antisocial.
Antisocial personality disorder is an adult disorder characterized by a long-term pattern of disregard for, or violation of, the rights of others. The term first appeared in DSM-II in 1968, where it replaced the earlier incarnation, sociopathic personality disturbance, which was pretty much the same idea. And if you're using ICD-10 for billing, you'll find it under dissocial personality disorder. Again, pretty much the same thing. But it's not the same as conduct disorder, which is the childhood equivalent of antisocial and is characterized by repeated antisocial acts that are not age appropriate. And that distinction is important because only 24 to 40% of youth with conduct disorder go on to have full antisocial personality disorder as adults. So we don't want to take away hope by diagnosing the personality disorder too early. A lot of times, a change of environment is all the child needs. Joel Paris is a specialist in personality disorders, and he believes that only 2 of the 9 personality disorders in the DSM have a strong scientific foundation.
Of the 10 personality disorders in the DSM, 8 of them could be thrown out tomorrow and we wouldn't miss them. The only ones which really have serious research behind them are antisocial and borderline.
He also believes that psychiatrists are overdiagnosing a lot of conditions at the expense of others. Find out why when we interview him next Monday.
We'd like to give a special thanks to our anonymous listener who downloaded the 1 millionth episode of the Carlat podcast last month. We don't know who you are, and you may not even know yourself, but you brought us over a pretty big threshold when you downloaded that episode on how to use a light box. Each of you helped us pave that way since our first episode launched in May of 2019. Thank you.